You're listening to Market Champions, a podcast on navigating the financial markets. Here's your host, Srivastava Prakash.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Market Champions. Today we've got Grant Williams, who is the author of Things That Make You Go Hmm, as well as he's got 35 years of experience in the market. So it's awesome to have you on. Thank you so much for being on the podcast, Grant.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
So I first wanted to start by, you know, talking a little bit about your background, you know, how you got into finance and your journey to, you know, where you are today.
Well, look, I got into finance, I guess, more by luck than anything else. It was something I wanted to do, but I was very fortunate to have worked kind of in temporary jobs in finance during my during my kind of junior and senior year in high school vacations. And I got offered a job by one of those people when I'd finished school, and I had an opportunity to go to university and decided that if I went to university 4 years later, I'd be trying to get a job again. So, and in the UK, this is 1985. So in the UK back then, it was very much the exception rather than the rule that people went to university. So it just seemed much more sensible for me to take the job. And so I got a job in the what was then called the back office at a merchant bank called Robert Fleming & Co., which has long since vanished into the deepest recesses of JP Morgan Chase. Kind of got thrown into the Japanese equity markets in the mid 1980s. So it was a baptism of fire in a crazy bull market.
Right.
And that was kind of where it all started. And from there, it's kind of it's taken me all over the world and brought me into contact with just some phenomenal people. So, you know, I've loved every minute of it.
Right. Yeah, that's awesome. And I wanted to go into, you know, your views on sort of the end game. And now I wanted to ask you, you know, where are we, you know, from a historic standpoint with the subject of fiat currency debasement? And what's sort of the difference between, you know, fiat currency debasement and inflation? And, you know, what's the significance of that difference for markets?
Well, look, you know, when you ask the question, where are we in terms of history, the answer, sadly, is nowhere we haven't been before. That's the great tragedy of this. You know, it's all so predictable and it's all so simple to see coming. Now the nuances of each time are a little different, but at any time you give politicians the ability to promise and spend and print money, the same thing happens. And we're there again. So there are things going on here. Obviously, QE in its current form is kind of new, and negative interest rates are not, it's not the first time they've been tried, but it's kind of new in terms of the broader adoption of them. So, you know, I think if anybody sits and looks back through history and real war, it's very hard to make the argument that it ends any differently this time than it has done the previous times. And the length of time it endures for is unknown. You have to think we're closer to the end than we are the beginning. And really, you know, I think the big point of this is that everyone needs to understand the likely future course. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to be short the market your entire life. You know, people make this crazy assumption that when people talk about the potential negative outcomes, and I've been warning about these for some considerable amount of time, they still remain. What you do in the interim in terms of investing can take those into account. You don't have to position yourself for Armageddon. Somebody once said to me years ago, you know, don't invest for Armageddon because it only happens once. And that's absolutely right. Just being aware of historical parallels and understanding the likely end game, it gives you, I think, a much better chance of avoiding it when the time comes.
Got it. And, you know, what's sort of the difference between, you know, fiat debasement and inflation?
Well, look, one tends to lead to the other. It's not a case of what the difference is. When you debase currency, you generally cause inflation, and the harder you debase it, the higher the inflation goes. You're going to have to look back at Weimar Germany for that. And I've spoken a lot about this recently because I think it's an important debate to have, but there's a there's a couple of great books about this that your viewers should take a look at. One is called When Money Dies by Jens O. Parsons. And the other one is The Dying of Money by Adam Ferguson, both of which you can find in PDF form on the internet, and both of which will give you a real insight into how currency debasement causes inflation and what happens when that process accelerates. It's never fun, and many times it becomes downright scary.
Right. And, you know, what is sort of like the case against the end game, you know, where with all sort of the infrastructure bills and the vaccinations and so on and so forth, will we not actually see growth?
Well, yeah, look, we might well do. And obviously, given the comps from last year, we are going to see tremendous growth this year. Off last year's base, year over year, the US could see double-digit GDP growth, which mm-hmm. Won't surprise anybody. Anyone that's been paying attention is not going to be surprised by that. So it's not as though you're going to get a 10% GDP print and the world's going to go, oh my God, this is amazing. The US is growing at 10% a year. So you have to be very careful about headline numbers like that. Now, they will be trotted out when those numbers get printed, and there will be an awful lot of rosy press around them. But I don't think it's really going to cause anybody who's been paying attention to make any sudden kind of shifts. It's just the way it is. But when you talk about what the antidote to the end game may be, if that's the word you chose, then, you know, as one of our very first guests, Mike Green, said, the very first thing he said on the podcast was, of course, there is no end game. And he's absolutely right. There isn't an end game as such. This doesn't end. It carries on. But what we're trying to figure out is what the transition looks like from this period in monetary history to the next period. When does that start? How does it start? What causes it? What does it look like? And so that whole series of podcasts has been an exploration of that in an attempt to try and get a bunch of smart people to offer us their views on all those questions. And look, there isn't a right or a wrong answer. There's just different ways of looking at it. And so by being able to present multiple different potential outcomes, I think it ought to help people listening weigh up the different probabilities and come up with their own framework. That's really what this is all about. You know, if you're just going to listen to one person and then take what they've said as gospel and use that to base your investment moves around, then I think that's a kind of a foolish thing to do, because nobody knows, right? We're all trying to guess the future. So take as many inputs as you can, throw out the ones that you fundamentally disagree with, and then work out from the rest of them what you ought to do. It's really no more complicated than that.
Right. And, you know, with this sort of view in mind and with this sort of outlook in mind, you know, how would you go about constructing a portfolio when looking at this outlook?
Well, the big question that I think everybody has to wrestle with right now is the inflation-deflation debate. And I've talked about this a lot lately. You know, this we've had plenty of false, plenty of times where people said, oh, we're going to get big inflation and nothing's happened. And that's generally made people very complacent about the likelihood of inflation returning, which is fine because, look, for 40 years, 50 years, or 40 years, yeah, you haven't had to worry about it. And so over that 40-year period, portfolios have generally morphed and changed to adapt to best fit their surroundings. And those surroundings have been, let's be polite, disinflationary. So just about every portfolio in the world is constructed to prosper during disinflationary or deflationary times. So if you think that through, if we do see a return of inflation, then just about every portfolio in the world is not only set up incorrectly for those circumstances, but they're set up for the exact opposite conditions. And so everybody is going to have an awful lot of adjustments to make to their portfolio. So the question really is, you know, do you start making those adjustments now, or do you wait until you see the whites of inflation's eyes? And you know, I would argue that depending on your time preference, and that's always really the most important decision you have to make here. If you have a long-term time preference, then it's probably sensible to start adjusting your portfolio for inflation now. And you may be wrong in the short term. We've seen some prints today coming out which suggest that we are starting to see the embers of of inflation come to life. But if you have that long-term time horizon, then you can start shifting your portfolio around. And if you're wrong for the next year, year and a half, 2 years even, it's okay, because you are over the long term going to be positioned for what I suspect is a secular turn into diametrically opposing conditions.
And, you know, I wanted to take something you said there, which was sort of the inflation deflation debate. And, you know, well, why do you believe that, you know, sort of the deflationists tend to be wrong? Because, you know, they're sort of, you know, they sort of believe that, you know, the Fed's problem is not so much generating, stopping inflation as much as it is, you know, generating inflation. Now they're having trouble actually creating inflation. So, you know, why do you believe that, you know, the deflationists as a whole, you know, tend to be wrong?
Well, again, you know, you have to come back to this time preference. Do I think they're wrong today? No, I don't. It's clear right. that for today, they're right. The problem here is trying to figure out, A, if you think they're likely to be wrong, and B, if you think that's the case, okay, how far in the future are we going to have to go until they are wrong? That's really the question you have to answer. You know, inflation is actually not that difficult to create. If you want to create inflation, it's actually a very straightforward thing to do, right? What they need to create, though, is mild, consistent, steady inflation. And that is virtually an impossible thing to create. If you want to create 2% inflation, as we've seen them try and do, it's virtually impossible. Now they've said that we're going to let inflation run hot. They're going to, you know, look through a lot of things and declare them transitory. We're already starting to see that come through. And, you know, we see CPI print today, that's, you know, I think 2.6%.
Right, yeah.
We're seeing all kinds of signs that inflation is heating up. It's already gone through their target. They're very, very deliberately and consistently talking about how, don't worry if inflation runs up, we're going to let it average over time. And we hear this in just about every Fed governor speech, that they're going to average 2% over time. But what they never, ever do is talk about what that time frame is. Right, they never say we want to average 2% over a year or over 2 years or over 5 years. They never say that, and of course they don't, because it gives them absolute flexibility in their targeting. So they've talked about how determined they are to create inflation. They will succeed. There is no doubt about it. They may have to get more creative and may have to start, you know, injecting money directly into the veins of the economy through Main Street rather than Wall Street, but they'll get there. The question then becomes, can they keep it under control? And I suspect history would suggest that once you get inflation running hot, as they've said they would like, it's very difficult to tamp it back down. And that's made all the more complicated by the sheer amount of debt on everybody's balance sheet, that your normal tool for controlling inflation being higher interest rates creates a parallel but way more dangerous feedback loop. So it's very tough to see how the Federal Reserve and other central banks around the world can extricate themselves from this particular corner they painted themselves into without significant pain being felt somewhere.
Right. And, you know, would you not agree, though, that, you know, today's print of 2.6% year on year was just, you know, the cause of base effect. So, you know, if you look at what happened last year, you know, March was when all the lockdowns came in. And, you know, in March, we saw a dramatic, you know, fall in the CPI. So therefore, you know, it's sort of the base is extremely low because, you know, we just had the lockdowns in March 2020. So wouldn't you say that today's print is purely because of base effects?
Sure. Look, everyone's been saying that we should expect higher inflation April, May, and June. So it's not a surprise. But if you look at month-on-month numbers, there you'll see some very interesting spikes. And again, don't forget, inflation is a mindset issue, right? Inflation expectations are really what caused the problem. If people... Mm-hmm. Yeah. See inflation running hot and expect it to go higher, that's when they start creating inflation of their own by getting out and using their money to chase goods. So look, it's always very nuanced, but know that the prints are not a surprise to anybody. We all knew the comps, as we will do with GDP, but the month-on-month numbers are, I would imagine, surprising a few people. And it really feels like the beginning of something rather than the end of it. And so if we're at the beginning of a potential inflationary cycle, again, the damage that 3% inflation can do in an era of 0% interest rates is significant. You know, don't forget, every percentage point positive that inflation is essentially is a real rate, because interest rates are zero. So you don't have that cushion, and that becomes a problem very, very quickly. So look, we'll see. We really don't know how this plays out. And more importantly, we don't know on what timeline it plays out, but there are plenty of parallels to give us strong clues as to what might happen. And there's plenty of data. Look, the Fed have stopped publishing M2 numbers, right? I mean, why on earth would they do that? They've been publishing them forever. And of course, suddenly the M2 numbers are spiking through the roof because of what's happened over the last year. And now they're going to stop publishing them, which is a huge red flag that anybody paying attention ought to be looking at. So, you know, yes, the base effects are well known, but look at the month-on-month numbers and remember that inflation expectations are every bit as important as the headline number.
Absolutely. And so where do you stand on the gold versus Bitcoin debate? You know, when you ask people, you know, who, you know, believe that, you know, we're going to see inflation, you know, there's usually this debate between, you know, owning gold versus owning Bitcoin. And, you know, where do you stand on that, you know, on that debate?
Well, it's funny how it's become a debate, right? I mean, both of them essentially perform the same function. So why has it become a debate? Why has it got to be one or the other? It can absolutely be both. And once you realize it can absolutely be both, then there's no stigma in being someone that would prefer to have gold, because they have experienced gold. They have a much longer track record with which to evaluate its likely performance. And there's no shame in being someone that sees Bitcoin as the future and deciding that Bitcoin is the way to go. The real tragedy of the whole thing is for two camps of people who essentially believe the same thing. One of them believe in the analog and trusted technology, and one believes in the digital and future technology. There's no reason these two groups can't coexist. So it kind of makes me chuckle that it's such a heated competition between the two. And you know, everyone has their own preference. Both of them will perform well. The fact that Bitcoin has been outperforming gold significantly in recent months is great for the Bitcoin holders. It's frustrating for the gold holders, but it's the reality. I mean, I don't see why everyone gets bent out of shape about it. And you know, what I really can't stand is the incivility of the whole thing. I don't find it a very pleasant debate to get involved in. I've tried to stay out of it, not because I don't understand both sides, but because I just can't be bothered to put myself in the middle and talk to a group of people on either side who are so set in their ways and rigid in their beliefs that they won't listen to the arguments on the other side. You know, I understand the case for Bitcoin. I have several questions that for me, I haven't had satisfactory answers to yet. And so for me, it's not a huge focus. It's not something that I'm investing an awful lot of time and money in. There's an awful lot of the price going up being the reason why a lot of people are getting involved in it rather than its likely future. But that's fine. We've seen that. We saw that in gold. We saw that in gold back in 2011, right? When gold was screaming up through 1900, everyone was talking about gold, right? And how everyone should own gold, but it was the price. The price draws people to it like moths to a flame. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a debate between a lot of people, but I really don't see the point in it being a debate. I don't understand why it is a debate. Both of them are perfectly acceptable for the people that choose to pick one or the other.
Got it. And are there any other commodities that you see attractive? You know, a couple of months ago, I was talking to, you know, the legendary commodity investor, Jim Rogers, and, you know, he was piling into, you know, sugar and soybeans and et cetera. You know, are there any other commodities that you see, you know, that you see attractive? You know, for example, metals like silver and copper, anything else that you see attractive?
Yeah, look, I think there's two answers to that. One is a complicated answer. One is a straightforward answer, right? And for most people, investing in commodities is a very tricky business, right? Investing in physical commodities is a very tricky business, and it's only something that professional investors and those that really are experienced in trading commodities can do. The other side of that coin is to buy ETFs. And if you're at that, you're in that subset where you just want to be long commodities and buy ETFs, and that's exactly what you should do. And if the inflation environment runs as expected, where we get inflation, then all commodities will run. So, you know, you should have broad exposure unless you really understand the ins and outs of the soybean market, you understand the ins and outs of cattle futures, whatever it may be, then fine, go ahead and pick one. But if the broader regime turns out to be what inflation is expected to be, then inflation is a tide which will float all of those boats in the commodity. So there are plenty of vehicles you can do that. In fact, well, I recently did a podcast with James Davolos of Horizon Kinetics, who have an inflation basket ETF, which is really interesting. INFL is the ticker. There are very few portfolios that have broad exposure to commodities. So it's a pretty straightforward thing to increase that exposure, you know, by buying ETFs. Unless you are an experienced professional investor and you want to dive into commodity futures, then by all means do so. But it's a very specific skill set to do it that way.
Got it. And then I was just curious, you know, if you were a central banker, or you know, if you were the head of the Federal Reserve right now, you know, what would you be doing right now?
God forbid. Jim Grant always has the best answer whenever he's asked that question. He says, you know, what's the first thing you would do if you were made the chair of the Federal Reserve? He says, resign. And he's absolutely right. You know, these guys are in a terribly tough position, but it's one of their own making. So I don't necessarily think there's an awful lot of sympathy for them. Somehow you've got to find a way to raise interest rates. There has to be a cost of capital. There has to be a cost of money. You know, money can't be free. It's not that kind of commodity. But in doing that, they're going to upset the apple cart. So they're in a bind. I suspect that they will at some point be forced into doing things like yield curve control to stop some kind of monetary collapse. I suspect they won't be successful. Ultimately, monetary systems throughout history have always reached their end of life. And this one feels like, if it's not quite there yet, it's certainly, you can see it from here. And at that point, really, it's going to be a cleanup on aisle three situation. And that's what the Fed are going to be called to do. They will need to get creative to keep things under control. And then when all hell lets loose, they will possibly lose their independence and become part of government. That wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. But they will also have to, you know, come up with things like yield curve control, the way they've done in Japan. Look, right. It's not going to end well. It's not going to end well. There's no two ways about it. There is no easy glide path out of this situation. There's been a series of steps and remedies put in place over the last 20 years to try and ameliorate problems which have arisen as direct response to the previous measures put in place by the Fed. So it's just been compounding for almost 30 years now. In fact, just a little over 30 years. So at some point, when you're trying to put out the next fire, you realize you're out of water. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's to fiscal from monetary. And that will likely carry the load for the next little while, but it's also going to create that inflationary problem, which is the Fed's to deal with. And the way, as I've said before, the way they're supposed to deal with it is to raise interest rates and tighten monetary conditions, which is something they just can't do anymore. So what would I do if I was the chairman of the Fed? I'd give the control reins to Jim Grant, and I'd resign before he did, frankly.
Got it. Have you ever, I just wanted to ask, you know, have you ever gone through, for, say, you know, Jeff Snyder's work? And, you know, I wanted to ask, do you have an opinion on his idea of, say, a dollar shortage and, you know, the take that the Federal Reserve doesn't actually print money and doesn't have control over the global monetary system?
Yeah, look, I think Jeff's fantastic. I really do. I think his work is unique and it's very well thought out. I understand the logic behind the dollar supply shortage, and at face value it definitely makes sense. What I don't believe is that it will ultimately be a problem. You know, we keep waiting for this huge dollar spike, and my gut feeling is that we may have seen it. But again, you know, that this dollar bull, dollar bear debate is another one that sucks everybody into it. And everybody gets all kind of riled up on both sides of the debate. And at any given point in time, one side is right and one side is wrong. And that's going to continue. You know, I think we would have seen a dollar spike by now if we were going to see one. I suspect that the Fed are going to get even more serious about weakening the dollar. And again, it's something I suspect they'll be able to do. Lord knows they could actually talk it down if they wanted to. There's always this narrative about the strong dollar, but that may change. They may actually actively start to discourage the strong dollar. If they do, it'll fall like a stone. So yeah, I think Jeff's work is fantastic. I think he's incredibly credible. And in many ways, he's right. But I just don't see this super spike in the dollar coming. I could be completely wrong, but I just don't see it coming.
Got it. You know, let's go to Japan. And, you know, could you sort of explain, you know, how the Japanese, you know, end game, or, you know, how the, you know, how eventually, you know, Bank of Japan, you know, how do you think that's going to play out in your view? Because I believe you've spoken about it with Bill Fleckenstein. And, you know, I just wanted to ask you to explain that to our audience as well.
Well, you know, Japan is, many people would say, is just kind of ahead of the US on the same trajectory, but is a number of years ahead. And so it's a great object lesson for the kind of outcomes when the Japanese central bank has done certain things. People kind of take that and apply it to other countries. I don't think that holds water. The Japanese market, particularly the bond market, is very, very different to Western sovereign bond markets. And so it's not really a good comparison. Bill and I just had a conversation this week with Gerard Minnick on the Endgame podcast, who did a fantastic job of laying this out. Really, really exceptional work. And the question Bill's had is what if the Bank of Japan ends up owning all the debt and just they do essentially a debt swap with the Ministry of Finance? You know, they do this mythical infinite duration zero coupon bond, which exchanges all the debt for that. Will they do it? And Gerard's point was that, you know, they've effectively done it. This stuff has gone into the Bank of Japan's balance sheet, never to be seen again. So, you know, if that's the case, what happens from here? And of course, we don't know. This is an experiment. But the one thing I think we can agree on is that what happens in Japan should not be applied, particularly to the US. I mean, here's a country where the vast majority of its bond market is domestically owned, sovereign bond market is domestically owned. And Russell Clark, in another edition of the Endgame podcast, talked about the difficulties he had in just buying JGBs as a, you know, fully accredited investor. It's not an easy thing to do. So whatever happens in Japan absolutely will not be guaranteed to be the same path that Western central banks follow. We should definitely watch it and see what they do when confronted with certain problems, but really more as a guide to us of what will Western central banks likely try. And there's every possibility they will try the same steps that the Japanese have taken, you know, buying ETFs, buying equities, cornering their bond markets, and most importantly, I suspect, yield curve control, which is, you know, what the Japanese have done. But for the Japanese, it worked very well. They've pegged the 10-year rate and haven't really had to spend any money because no one's going to take them on. That won't be the case in the US. You know, if the Fed pegs the 10-year point in the yield curve, there are an awful lot of people who've been, I would argue, looking for an opportunity to dump their treasury holdings without causing themselves problems by lowering the price on the rest of their holdings. If the Fed offers an unlimited bid at a certain point in time, I suspect there'll be plenty of countries that will look to tap that bid. So it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out. But I think believing Japan to be any kind of seriously tight overlay is a big, big mistake for people to make.
Is it possible for sort of the BOJ to clean its balance sheet, but, you know, not cause either massive hyperinflation or crippling deflation? Is that possible under, you know, any circumstance?
Look, I think the past 10 years have told us anything's possible, right? I mean, does it make sense that it would be an easy thing to do? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. But could they do it? Yeah. And the day you start to believe that nothing is impossible is going to be a very good day, because we've been kind of bamboozled by so many points along the curve in this last 10 years. It's unlikely, But again, this comes back to this point that Japan is a very idiosyncratic bond market. And if anyone can get away with it somehow, it's the Japanese. Be interesting to see what happens to the yen if they do that. But they've got the best shot of anybody in getting away with it. It wouldn't be my base case to expect they will. But at this stage, look, nothing would surprise me anymore. I think you have to be ready for outcomes that you thought were unthinkable, and not necessarily be prepared for them in advance, but have a game plan for what happens and how you adjust if you're proven to be wrong. That's really what the Endgame podcast has been all about.
Absolutely. And I wanted to move to, you know, another thing, which was, you know, China and Russia, you know, have sort of been of concern lately, and especially among a lot of investors. So what other areas of the globe are you paying attention to? What other areas of the globe should be on, you know, our radar?
Well, I don't know that it's necessarily particular areas of the globe, but I think you have to be paying attention to geopolitics. I think what's changed is the lens through which you look at it needs to adjust, because if you continue to get your information on geopolitics from traditional mainstream media, I think it's a very dangerous thing to do, because given the nature of the increasing struggle between China and the US, and it's a very real struggle, you know, this is absolutely the Thucydides trap playing out in real time. The rise of China is important. And so given the seriousness of that battle between the two countries, you'd better believe that the media in both countries has been co-opted to make sure that the people watching those programs have the right impressions of what's going on. You better believe that. And so given the importance of geopolitics, it's never been more important to seek sources of reference for that and understanding of those dynamics from places outside the normal mainstream media channels. You know, you need to be finding people on Twitter that seem to have a different perspective, and then you need to, you know, research them and understand their biases. It's very difficult. You know, the more ways there are of getting information, the noisier it becomes and the harder it becomes to kind of cut through.
Yeah.
And find sources that you can trust. And that's really what is so important now, is trust. You have to find people you can trust to give you information and insight and opinion and analysis that isn't colored by some kind of outside bias. It's a really difficult thing to do. Make no bones about it. It's a really difficult thing to do, but I think it's important for everybody to try and do that. So, you know, when you're looking for trouble spots, for me, the media is perhaps the biggest trouble spot, because that's really the spigot for information. And, you know, there are people with their hand on the spigot controlling the flow for understandable reasons, if not justifiable. So it's a difficult thing for all of us to try and navigate.
And are there any sources that you would personally recommend that, you know, our audience, you know, check out or our audience follow?
Well, look, there are so many, right? But again, it's a case of doing what people, you know, what I find to be interesting isn't something that everybody should find interesting, and right. Many people won't. But I've gone through Twitter and I've gone through my own kind of Real Vision days of meeting people and you know, building a network of people that you could trust. And that really only comes from experience. It really only comes from meeting people and talking to people and reading people's work and having debates with them and finding the guys that you believe you can trust. You know, there are so many accounts on Twitter that I wouldn't even know where to start. But generally speaking, if you do find people that you trust on Twitter, then a good place to start is the people they follow and the people that they interact with. You know, that's a quick and easy way to start building a network. It's not as easy as just completely deciding, oh, I'm going to believe everything that this guy believes, I'm going to follow everyone that this guy follows. It doesn't work like that. It requires an awful lot of time.
Absolutely.
To invest in your own education and getting to know the people that you decide to trust. It's really it's just not a simple solution. And unfortunately today, everybody seems to be all about that simple solution. Oh, you know, what's the shortcut? Give me the five books I can read to tell me everything I need to know about this, and give me the five people that I should follow, and that way. And people get lazy. They really do. So in some ways, I always understand why people want kind of book recommendations, for example, and I'm always happy to give them. But when people say, I want to know who to follow in any walk of life, I think that's a very dangerous thing to do. I think being told who to follow is problematic. You should find people to follow and then see who they follow. And some of those people will be right for you and some of them won't be. But if you don't do that stuff on your own, you have no real idea why the person who told you to follow such and such a guy is following him. You don't know what it is about that person that appeals to him. So you have to gravitate to the people that resonate with you, and you have to do that organically. It's the advantage you have now is it's so easy to find so many of these people. Then you have to weed your way through them and you know, discard the people that you don't feel add value to you. But it's really not something that someone can do for you, unfortunately. Abdicating that responsibility, I just don't think is a sensible idea.
Got it. Now, you've also, you know, interviewed tons of people, and, you know, you've spoken with some of the greatest minds in finance, and they tend to make very compelling cases. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, not all the conclusions sort of overlap. So, you know, how do you go about, you know, reconciling, you know, these different views?
But isn't that great?
Exactly.
I mean, that's the best part. That's the best part of this is talking to smart people. And it comes back to that last question we just discussed. You know, it comes back to finding smart people and listening to what they have to say. Mm-hmm. And it's not always going to agree with the other smart people who you think, wow, that's really, you know, that's the best part though, because ultimately it's down to you. It's down to everybody to pick their own narrative, to do their own research, to make their own decisions, right? Unless you've completely outsourced it to a money manager, which is totally fine, but then you better understand the way that money manager thinks. But in trying to piece all this together on an individual basis, No one can do it for you. You have to get conflicting opinions. Absolutely. And then decide which one of them you feel is correct. That's it. It's no one else's job but your own. So, you know, all these people that I've interviewed, I mean, I've enjoyed every single conversation, and many of them have disagreed with other conversations that I thought were incredibly profound. But ultimately, it comes down to me deciding what I believe. You know, the inflation deflation debate is the perfect example. You know, on the one hand, you've got David Rosenberg and Lacey Hunt, two gentlemen that I have the utmost respect for. They are best in class, and they've been right about so many things for so long. And on the other hand, you have, you know, the Russell Napiers of the world who have flipped to inflation. You have the Gerald Minnicks of the world, also guys I have a tremendous amount of respect for. And I weigh up everything that they say. I take great interest in what they say, and I put great weight on all of it. But ultimately, you can't sit there with Lacey Hunt on one side and Russell Napier on the other, because either one of those would be someone that a lot of people say to you, oh, yeah, just follow Lacey Hunt or just follow Russell Napier. And if you did that, you'd be following a very, very smart person. But unless you think for yourself and decide which one of them makes the more compelling argument, you could be on the wrong side of it. And not because you followed a guy that didn't know his stuff, but that either you got the timing wrong, your time horizon was mismatched with Lacey's or Russell's, or they just happened to be wrong. And there's nothing wrong with being wrong when you're trying to predict the future, because it's something that none of us have an answer to, right? It's all of it's guesswork. So get as many educated guesses as you can, weigh them up yourself, but ultimately the onus is upon you to make decisions for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I agree with that. Who have sort of been your biggest mentors when it comes to, you know, investing in life, and, you know, what have you learned from them?
Well, that's a big question. I've been fortunate to have so many mentors from the people that I was around when I first started in the markets. You know, I worked for a guy called John Galvanoni, who was an extraordinary guy. a real character back in London in the mid 80s. And he was a piece of work, and I learned so much from him, you know, not all of it great, but all of it useful. I worked for a guy called Cliff Benford in my early days, again, who taught me a completely different set of things. I worked with a bunch of tremendous traders. A very good friend of mine, Andy Barnes, is one of the best traders I've ever seen. He's still a dear friend of mine, and I talk to him just about every day. So you have these kind of people that are mentors in that they've taught you things, not necessarily because they've taken under their wing, but you happen to have been around them and you've observed them and you've kind of taken things away from that. And then, you know, in later life, people like David Hay at Evergreen in Bellevue, Washington has been a tremendous mentor for me. Simon Mikhailovich, similar. I've learned so much from Simon over the last, you know, 10 years. It's extraordinary. And people like Tony Deaton, you know, Tony Deaton has been a tremendous mentor for me. And I've just been fortunate to be able to call on these people as resources and listen to them, really. I mean, that if you want a mentor, then 90% of the time is listening and 10% is asking questions. You know, because if you ask the right questions, the answers will be detailed and way more useful than listening to yourself talk. And I try to carry that mindset into all my Real Vision interviews. You know, I always figure that in an hour's conversation with someone, if I was talking for more than 5 minutes of that, I'd done something wrong, because it was all about me trying to get information from my guest. So, I think mentors don't need to be people who are older than you and wiser than you that kind of sit you down by a fireplace and tell you really deep, profound things. Mentors can be the guy you sit next to, right? Who just happens to be extraordinarily good at what he does. And you have a ringside seat to observe those people and maybe ask them the odd question about it. And so your mentorship in its traditional sense is fantastic. And you know, it's great for people to seek out these kinds of guides, but also paying attention to the people around you who are good at what they do and trying to soak as much in from them every day is, you know, it's kind of incumbent upon all of us, you know, to get smarter, to get better, to learn from mistakes. And that kind of information is all around you every day. You just have to be paying attention.
Absolutely. And, you know, I hope I've done a good job of asking questions today. And you know, when you've conducted, you know, all these interviews, you know, have there been any specific people, you know, that have sort of jumped out at you, and you know why?
Yeah, tons. I mean, tons of people. And it, for me, it always tended to be the unknowns, the people that weren't necessarily on the broader radar screen, who've been the most profound, because these people come out of nowhere and they really surprise you with kind of original thought and character. Mm-hmm. You know, Mark Cahodes is a great example of that. You know, Mark wasn't on people's radars really until I interviewed him in Real Vision, and I just happened to see Mark give a presentation at a grants conference. And there was clearly something very different about Mark. The way he thought, the way he acted was very different. And I find that interesting. So I contacted him and asked him if I could come out and interview him. And that was a remarkably profound conversation. You know, Tony Deaton is another name that wasn't on anybody's radar list. And I think my original Real Vision interview and the most recent podcast I did with Tony, I think it's brought him to much broader attention, which is fabulous. He doesn't want that attention and in fact shies away from it actively. But I think it helped a lot of people realize that there are guys like Tony out there thinking and practicing in the way they do. And then there are, you know, young guys like Daniel Want down in Australia from Prerequisite Asset Management, who I was sent a bunch of his writing to read, which I read, and I found really, really interesting. So I wanted to interview Daniel, and you know, he's a complete unknown in Brisbane, Australia. And when you sit and spend time in the presence of a mind like Daniel's, you realize just how big a place the world is, and how there are so many of these people, really, really bright people, you know, with a gift for communicating, who are out there and people don't know about them. So it's been an absolute thrill for me to be able to expose people like this to a broader audience. You know, Joe Duran is another one who sat down with me, and we had a remarkable conversation that really barely touched on markets at all. But I think a lot of people found that conversation incredibly profound, as did I. And so, you know, the people that have really resonated with me, while it's been fascinating to get time to sit down and talk with some of the legends in the business, it's the kind of lesser known people who are a surprise to many, and demonstrate that they're every bit as smart and every bit as inventive and original as the household names, but for some reason they're just not widely known. You know, Chris Cole is another one. Chris Cole is someone that I went to interview in Austin a bunch of years ago, when really he wasn't that well known. You know, Mike Green, another one. And these are brilliant, brilliant guys who, you know, thanks to social media and thanks to the ease of getting exposure, now have justifiably high recognition with investors. And that's the way it should be. You know, that's exactly the way it should be. These people should have the chance to become recognizable, and investors all around the world should have the chance to read their thoughts and hear them talk, because they're brilliant, each and every one of them.
And, you know, funny enough, that question actually did come from Mark Cohoda. So, yeah.
Well, there you go. He's the answer to his own question. That's so perfect for Mark.
Absolutely. And to wrap up the podcast, I wanted to ask you, you know, what are your top three tips for investors today?
Top three tips. Okay, we've covered one of them, I think, which is seek people out and listen. Mm-hmm. Listen, you know, and if you get the chance to ask questions, that's great. But you won't always have a chance to ask questions. But listen, and don't be afraid to decide that someone's wrong, because it's all guesswork, right? But listen to people and pay attention. I mean, it sounds like such a simple thing to do, but people struggle with it today. They really do. I think another one would be under any circumstance, and this is investing 101, you have to avoid the big drawdown. Don't be all in on something and have 100% conviction about anything. Don't hold tightly to any thesis. And if you do hold on to it that strongly, make sure you're checking it every single day. Because there will be one day when there's a chink in that thesis, and then you have some really, really tricky decisions to make. And the other tip I would give everybody is to read more history. You know, read history, financial history, human history, because all the answers are in there. They're all in there. As Ecclesiastes said, there's nothing new under the sun. It's a phrase I keep hearing and I keep repeating, because it's true. You know, none of this is new. And the answers are all in history. And I think by having a better understanding of the past, you have a better understanding of the future. You know, I've talked often about the book, The Lords of Finance, which I think does a great job of walking us through a period in time that has so many parallels to today. And Luke Grommond and I recently had a conversation on my podcast about another book, 1931, Debt Crisis and the Rise of Hitler, which is another fascinating look back to a very short period in time. And as you read this book, you can't help but have alarm bells going off in your head about how similar many aspects of it are today. And so if you can see similar period, how they played out, it doesn't guarantee they'll play out the same way, but it gives you a much better understanding of the likely roadmap and what you might need to do to protect yourself against it.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for being on the podcast, Grant. It was awesome having you.
You are more than welcome. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Market Champions. To never miss an episode, make sure to subscribe, and we'll see you next time.